podcast about Tom Waits, kind of. And now your hosts, Marios Kritiotis and Dave O'Brien.
Hey, welcome back to Rain Dogs, the only podcast about a band and or album. I'm Dave.
I'm Marios.
And we're here to talk about probably the greatest albums that you have been cornered by at a party to be lectured at by a guy who's had a little too much to drink. Probably
ideas. In his late 30s.
In his at least his late 30s, yeah.
And you know, another thing that I think it's perfect. I mean, number one, this was long overdue. All we got, you know, episode zero, the Clovis episode. Yeah. If you haven't listened, dear listener, stop this right now. Go back and listen to Clovis. Everything in there is important canon, really. It's important Rain Dogs canon.
Context. Yeah, like, think of it like a prologue almost, I think. Yeah.
It is a prologue. That's exactly what it is. It's perfect.
Yeah.
It's a perfect description. Still no Tom Waits podcast, because I was looking every week, because I was like, because you and I have been planning to do this for
years,
every month. We like, we should do this for 48 months.
Yeah. And they so say not that long, but when you say you should do something, that's almost as good as doing the thing. So we've been really
and especially for us, you know, the college try is still valid, despite the fact that I've been out of college for almost 20 years. Very long time.
Wow. You're so old.
This is like the, you know, Mark McGwire in the on the A's, you know, like feel, you know, like we're just like primo ready to like wreck it, you know, like we're juiced up.
Yeah. Found the perfect balance of steroids that works for us. HGH, whatever. I'm sorry.
Creatine.
Yep. I think
he was on that for a while. Mm-hmm. Was it the A's? Yeah. The Bash Brothers, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't even remember, but
remember baseball.
Oh no, but there's still no. So you know, I would routinely check Spotify and other platforms, and there are still no podcasts about Tom Waits. There's a little rumor on the in the Waitsosphere that he is thinking about making new music. So that's pretty tight.
So we got to get in there. Got to get in there fast.
This time could not be better.
Now, you
know, we're happy he's with us still. That was another concern.
Also find out that maybe there's a reason there haven't been any other Tom Waits podcasts out there. Are you familiar with the great filter theory of like intelligent life on other planets?
Where
like, you know, if you there's something that's just keeping civilizations that reach a certain level of advancement, you know, from progressing or from existing, like something wipes them out, like they destroy themselves through environmental devastation, nuclear war. What if the reason why there are no other Tom Waits podcasts is because as soon as Tom Waits finds out about one, he just like shows up at their house and beats the shit out of them.
Like with like an empty bottle of bourbon. And like, he's like just the most like stereotypical. He looks like a protagonist from a Charles Bukowski semi-autobiographical novel.
Yeah, you're just going to like pull into your driveway from work one day and like an angry man in a pork pie hat is just going to be waiting for you.
or it's like just the nature of people who obsess over Tom Waits that they do one episode of their Tom Waits podcast and then never publish anything else because they're just like wandering around, like, you know, reading obscure like interviews that he did with like Bomb Magazine or something. And you're like, this is going to be great for podcast number whatever. And then 2 years go by and you're still thinking about something your friend said about, you know, Downtown Train 2 years ago that we never put to wax. So,
I'm
sure that could be it.
So us, basically.
A full 2 years have gone by. What have we missed? You know, what's been going on? What's going on in your life? You know, like, what's going on in what have we missed? What big events?
I mean, we've had a Barbenheimer. We've had various
other
things.
We've had a Barbenheimer.
Yeah, we've had some wars, I feel like. Actually, big news, I've started playing guitar again.
That's right.
Yeah, I finally dug up my old Telecaster from, like, storage, really. And, of course, it needed to be repaired. I found, like, a really great repair shop nearby. Apparently, no one tells you this when you're in high school, but, like, if you really like guitars, you can just, like, get a job repairing those. And, you know, like, not worry, deal with a lot of, like, the, I don't know, office job nonsense, which apparently no one told me about. But
Have to like, you don't have to know what like an iCalendar invite is.
Yeah,
you know?
I bet you rarely have to Zoom.
There's probably no circling back in the guitar repair.
Yeah, industry. You don't put a pin in anything. You don't CC anybody.
No CCs, no BCCs for sure.
Yeah. But it's pretty exciting. So a friend of mine like started making his own like pedals over the pandemic, just like got into soldering and doing that kind of stuff. So he like made a version of a King of Tone for me and mailed it to me. And I was like, all right, well, shit, now I actually have to start playing guitar again if someone has gone out of their way to do something this nice. I got it from the repair shop yesterday, and I've been playing around, and some of it's coming back to me, and some of it's like, oh, right, this is hard. I have to, like, work at this a lot, and my soft, flabby fingers are just, you know, nowhere even close to the shape they need to be in to play a stringed instrument. So I'm getting back into the grind, I guess.
The Tele, you know, but that's a beautiful sounding guitar.
Oh, it's gorgeous.
You know,
yeah.
Get a couple licks in there, you feel so good. It's majestic.
It's not
that's,
like
that's kick ass, man.
It's, you know, it's what Bruce Springsteen plays. Right?
The Boss plays it, you know, and I have made a list. I actually have a note right here that says don't mention Bob Dylan. I'm going through actually. I was going to save this for what happened to me between 2022 and 2024, but we might as well just go make a quick pit stop here. Going through a major Randy Newman phase in my life.
Oh, nice. Underappreciated.
He might be like, I don't know. Like, I remember when I first like discovered John Prine, and everyone knows I'm like a Dylan simp, you know, like I'm just a total nut freak.
You love a gravelly voice singer-songwriter.
Yeah, but like Randy, oh man, there's something kind of like sneakily better than every, like all of them. Like he's funnier than John Prine.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's like musically better than Dylan, like in terms of just being like the architecture of the song.
Yeah,
he's like, well, like he's like he's even, and he's also like more deceptive. Like there is not one autobiographical thing that Randy Newman sings about. Like I can think of a couple, even on this album.
Oh yeah,
that we're about to talk about with Tom Waits. Like
Tom Waits has never been on an Uptown Train. He's only ridden Downtown Trains his entire life.
But like even Dylan and even Tom Waits like have exposed themselves in some way in song. I really don't know if Randy Newman has before 1990. There's a song that he made that he put out on an album called Bad Love that I think might be autobiographical. But that's it.
Yeah.
His entire 70s and 80s output are just like these like sardonic kind of racist stuff to like he's just like crazy. I don't know. Yeah. Like I can't get my I can't even talk about it. We should be doing we're not doing a Randy Newman podcast.
Maybe next. He's the kind of guy who writes like Warren Zevon-esque lyrics and still those soundtracks to Pixar movies, right? Like that's range.
Yeah. Zevon is definitely like his soul brother. Yeah. You know, I think that's probably like the closest. Yeah. Anyway, oh no, but Dylan, that was a long tangent to get back to the Telecaster, but one of the only electric guitars that Dylan played was the Telecaster.
What did he play at the...
On, like the Rolling Thunder tour.
Rolling Thunder, yeah. That. When he first went electric, was it Newport Folk when he first went electric? Do you know, what did he play on that?
That I don't know. I would love to. I'm going to look. I should know that.
Yeah, but, I'm kind of disappointed in you, honestly. What would the Jokerman say, Mark?
The Jokerman, I know you're listening. Thank you for not doing Tom Waits. That was another big thing. I was like, because like we're two guys that are like, I don't want to like call ourselves literary adjacent because it sounds douchey, but like two like literary adjacent dudes who like think that they know things that, you know, think that what we have to say about these artists is important.
We're just two overeducated guys who have been overvalidated by society.
Overvalidated by society, probably under listened to by the people that we scream about Tom Waits to. And so, but yeah, thank you, Jokerman, for choosing the Beach Boys and not Tom Waits. Maybe one day we'll get the Jokerman on. Maybe we can do theirs. I think we would be a lot of synergy there.
Yeah.
I know Evan is the dude from there. He's reading a lot of like rereading a lot of Burroughs and Bukowski, which is what I've been doing lately as I've been like re-listening to Rain Dogs.
Are you okay? Do we need to have a check-in? Like how are you feeling?
I feel so. Here's the deal. Like, I don't know. I feel like I was like a Jack Kerouac boy, you know. And
yeah. JKB.
When I was reading Burroughs and Bukowski, I was like, that was the age where like you would take the Pat bus to the Andy Warhol Museum, and you would think you were like deep and cool because you were reading a copy of like Women or something outside of the Warhol Museum. But I was 18. I mean, this was 20 years ago, and so. I was listening to Rain Dogs actually to like prep for this and you know, and I was like, this is so I've been reading Junkie from William Burroughs, and it's like very, it's so, they just are very kind of just, I mean, he was clearly in the same mindset making this music, although he was a little more mature when he made that. This is not a new Tom Waits album. I mean, or this is not a classic.
Yeah.
I mean, it's classic now in retrospect, but it's not like 70s. You know, this came out in like 86.
Yeah. He was well established at the time.
85.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, he'd been playing for
we're in Reagan's second term at that point. Should we provide some context, like what's going on in the world when this comes out? You know, we're deep into the Cola Wars. Actually, here's a fun game. What do you have the date this was released? What was at the top of the charts? Like, what was mainstream America listening to when Rain Dogs?
September 30th, the Billboard Hot 100, number one, very much in the Rain Dogs canon here, in the Rain Dogs sphere. Money for Nothing from Dire Straits was number
one. Dire Straits. So. That is probably one of the best dad bands of all time.
Yeah. Like, I mean, you can't, like, so.
Mark Knopfler, one of the best classic rock guitarists out there.
Knopfler, oh my God. The older I get, the more I think he's, like, even better. Like, yeah. I was just like, oh man. Like, I was just listening to the. Not to go off topic again, but the Dire Straits self-titled debut album is so nuts. It's so good.
Yeah.
It's, you know, just like,
man, I'm actually I'm looking at this chart, and like, I was expecting to see a lot of like pop stuff or like hair metal, and like, and so we could like draw a contrast. Like, it's pretty solid. Number one's Dire Straits. Number two is Cool in the Gang. Then you got Wham, Phil Collins, Ready for the World I Don't Know, but then Madonna, Aha. John Parr from the St. Elmo's Fire soundtrack, then Whitney Houston and John Cougar Mellencamp, and then Dancing in the Street, Mick Jagger and David Bowie's number 11, and then Tina Turner's We Don't Need Another Hero from, I believe, Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome.
I think you're right.
Yeah.
Like, I believe that was...
Honestly, some interesting stuff going on musically at the time this came out.
Well, and again, you know, We talk about what great artists were doing in the 80s. You know, the 80s are not known as happy times for a lot of these, like, when you think of like the Mount Rushmore of songwriters, at least like, you know, of that era, like if you're thinking of like the Joni Mitchells of the world, the Neil Youngs of the world, the Bob Dylans of the world, Tom Waits, you know, even like fucking I'm blanking now on like a Tom Petty.
Oh yeah.
Like, you know, the 80s were not a happy, like, critically, it's like a time, like, you know, if you're a pervert like me and you go back and listen to Empire Burlesque from Bob Dylan, like, and you find songs that you really like from it, that's what one thing, but like, they were not good albums at the time.
Yeah.
You know, the Neil Young one with the like fucking vocoder he was using and shit, like Neil Young one.
Was that Trans?
Not a good album.
Yeah. Wasn't that one of the ones he sued his record company over or label over at some point? Yeah. But yeah, like, and also like personally too, was like in like the formulaic like biopic story arc of most of their lives, this is like the sad montage where their second wife leaves them or whatever, you know, like.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, they've all like, you know, I was reading something that this, what's this dude's name? He was in, a cool DC punk band called Nation of Ulysses. Do you remember this band? They were like a DC I don't like a Bad Brains era. Is it Nation of Ulysses? But the guy, the front man of that is this cool. Yeah, Nation of Ulysses is the name of the band. The guy, I forget his name now. He's a great writer. He's a, like one of those dudes that just knows kind of how to. He knows how to twist and turn a phrase on the, on paper, Dave. You know, he's just one of those guys.
Yeah.
And he's a, an apologist of the 80s output of a lot of these guys, because I think he was like, you don't understand what was happening. Everybody was on smack in the 70s. Everyone was just totally smacked out of their mind. And so a lot of them by the end, like, turned to religion, you know, like Dylan famously converted to Christianity.
Yeah.
You know, Neil was constantly, you know, constantly trying to get off of the stuff. And so you get to the 80s. There's this huge revolution of how music is being recorded. Like, everyone's doing like the weird big reverby, like drum machines.
Yeah.
And I think people were like, we're going to try new things. We're going to turn a new corner. We've been playing music, you know. Neil had been, by the time, been playing music for 20 years by then, you know, and Tom Waits' first album came out, what, like 69? Maybe 70.
Something like that, yeah.
That closing time was, I can't remember when. I love,
I like, and, you know, I love listeners, we know a lot about all of these artists, and you should be listening.
We know all the trivia of Tom Waits. Yeah, oh, 73. Yeah, so closing time was 73. So he'd been in the game for 12 years. He'd had,
and he was, I mean, he'd been performing before 70, before yeah. closing time. Yeah.
8 records before,
Rain Dogs came out.
So, yeah. I mean, some bands don't even have 8 albums, you know, like,
yeah.
The Rolling Stones don't have 8 albums that I think are good.
Yeah.
You know,
Television and doesn't have anywhere near it.
Television. Albums. Yeah. So, you know, this guy gets to 85. Most of his peers have submitted to the sounds of the people, right? The sounds of the times. Yeah. Everyone's doing synths. Everyone's doing drum machines. Everyone's got that like Joy Division, like reverby guitar, which yeah. is, or I'm sorry, reverby drums and reverby yeah. guitar, yeah. but which is reverb great.
Yeah.
I'm a big slut for reverb over yeah. here. I'm not going to say no to that.
Big Joy Division stands. Yeah.
Yeah. Never a no. Right. But Tom Waits decides to make an album. By the way, it was a total heel turn from the rest of this stuff. I mean, this guy was doing, speaking of Lounge Lizard stuff, but you know, he's doing these piano songs, he's doing these, you know, kind of almost Randy Newman-esque, you know, type of jazzy. You know, he's like funny, kind of funny songs. You know, the piano yeah. has been drinking. You know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. He got really into, like, and, the story songs, you know, like a really, like, a grim, dark Billy Joel, almost, if that makes any sense.
So, yeah, Jersey Girl. That yeah. album, Heart Attack and Vine, is very Billy Joel-coded. You're so right.
Dude. Yeah.
So, we've got this album now. Like Dave said, we're in the heart of the Cola Wars. Pepsi and Coke are going at it. You know what? I had a Pepsi. I had a Pepsi the other day. I've been a Coke guy.
You think it's switching?
It was so nice.
Yeah. You know, it's nice to just mix it up a little bit.
Pepsi, sponsor us. Let's go. Drop, you know, let's send us some merch.
No way. I'm holding out for RC Cola. RC is the thinking man's cola. RC, if you're listening to this, yeah. give us money.
Send us some t-shirts.
Yeah.
We'll wear them.
Yeah.
When we have a Patreon, we'll do the video. You know, if you're a patron, you get to watch us on Zoom.
Yeah.
Like, you know, drink mezcal and talk about the stupid shit and look stupid.
Uh-huh. But we'll be wearing RC Cola shirts and hats.
Yeah, okay. Right. In the glow of our laptop screens, we'll have these beautiful RC
or
Cola.
Or Dr. Pepper or Mr. Pibb or whoever makes the best offer, really.
We'll take anybody's yeah. money, honestly.
Yeah.
But all we need is for this to blow up and then we don't have to go do our real jobs. We can just do this.
Yeah.
So,
which I'm told is a viable career path.
Totally. Yeah, we could totally do this. You said on the last one, I was re-listening some of our last one. Again, in preparation for this, and you had a legendary line when we were, I said something slightly like unprofessional and I was like, oh, I should probably be careful or whatever. And you were like, nobody who's happy with their job is making a podcast.
That's true.
Well, I guess without further ado, we might as well begin discussing this album. Like we had mentioned, big, you know, Tom Waits had begun to change his style around a little bit with the previous album, Swordfish Trombones. Actually, this represents an informal trilogy that he was that Waits has begun to call. It's a loose concept trilogy about the urban dispossessed, and that trilogy includes Swordfish Trombones, Rain Dogs, of course, and then Frank's Wild Years is the final in that trilogy, which I think obviously will be. Talking about all three of those albums, but beginning with Rain Dogs, because, you know, it's the title of our show, and I do think it's the most important one as well. But yeah, so number right out of the gate, we've got now, and again, this is a guy, he's in every interview, he says this is an album about New York City. I was living in New York City, and I was inspired by the sounds of New York City. And what's the first song he decides to go with, Dave?
The very first song is about, is called Singapore.
We sail tonight for Singapore, where all is mad as hatters here. I've fallen for a tawny moor, took off to the land of none, drank with all the Chinamen, walked the sewers of Paris, I danced along the colored wind.
Which is not New York City. I think you don't need to know a lot about geography to realize.
Not only is it not about New York, but it's like a... I kind of like consider this song a sea shanty of sorts.
Like, yeah, it's got heavy pirate vibes. Like, there is...
Yeah, like...
There's a non-zero chance that Johnny Depp listened to this while preparing to be Captain Jack Sparrow.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It's even got like the Mad Hatter line, you know.
And he paints Singapore much like he does with New York City as like this almost mythical place, right? Like he's just sort of describing it like it's a sort of fairy tale fantasy land, like a grim, weird one, but still like, you know, like a very sort of like a place from a fable almost.
Right. Like, yeah. Like he's like, don't fall asleep while you're ashore.
Yeah.
You know, like. Through the alley back from hell when you hear the steeple bell. I just remember, like, I never could get into Tom Waits. I could never breach that impenetrable wall of his, like, voice. And, like, I couldn't figure out if it was serious or not. And so I made the earnest. I Googled. I went to the internet, and it was like, what's the best Tom Waits album? And this one is so universally, like, you know, accepted as the high... watermark of an entire high watermark of a career, and this is the first song that I put on, and I was like, is this a joke? Like, is this isn't real. This can't be a real song.
Yeah, it's a I remember, and I'm sure we talked about this in our first episode, but like this was the first album that I was able to get into too. Like I had it in my head that, like, you know, like just through cultural osmosis, like I had absorbed that, like, Tom Waits is like the cool artist to listen to, that like cool music snobs like. And I'd heard a lot of his song. Like I tried lots of his stuff, and I was like, this is just not music by any definition I'm aware of. This is someone who seems to actively not want people to like listen to his music. And this album was where it clicked. I don't think, now it wasn't like an immediate thing where, like, you know, I hit the first track and Singapore comes on. I'm like, oh, this is genius. But I do like,
right.
But it was like
a man yelling, like, wipe him down with gasoline.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, what is going on here?
But I do remember thinking,
this is
like
a Muppet.
Yeah. Like, yeah. Like, you know, this is interesting. This is at least different. I think I was a teenager at the time. So I was like, all right, well, you've got my attention. Let's see where you go with this. So
right.
I don't know if I would call it a strong opening, but I would call it a confident opening. This is like how a man who is, this is how you begin your album if you are not at all concerned about, like, you know, trying to hook people immediately. If you're just so confident in your work that, like, all right, this is how we're starting. And so when we say, like, start an album, we mean, like, back in the day. Like, when this came out, it was, like, a vinyl LP, and when we listen to it, it's on CDs, right? So when we say listen to an album, it's not like you could just go onto Spotify or whatever and like listen to a single and individual track, right? You like sat down, like you bought the CD from, you know, Borders or Tower Records or, you know, or wherever. And then, you know, like you hit track one and it started and you were just sitting there listening to everything back to back in the way that the artist or the record company like planned it out, right? So like it was a big deal, which was number one, because like number one, number two, number three, like there's a whole science and psychology behind it that I guess is maybe a lost art. Yeah.
Sequencing is so like the older another thing in my old age, like sequencing an album is so like I love to like be a freak about sequencing. Do love it.
Anyone who's ever made a mixtape for someone they wanted to impress understands how important it is to like, you know, arrange the first few tracks to like really get them on board.
Well, and then so like, and then, you know, the funny thing about Singapore is like, you know, as unserious as I think it felt after like taking the whole album in, you know, and you get to the final song and then like going back, I love it. Like I love Mark Ribot's guitar. It feels like it's doing something completely different from the rhythm section. It's like he's playing notes that make sense, but like he's also kind of it's a little slouched. It's not structured really the way a normal song. Like he's not hitting notes. Like it's not a scale that he's playing. Yeah. Like it's not even a mode. He's just like going up and down the. It sounds like somebody like a kid playing with a guitar in Guitar Center. Like it's like bang 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 bang. But like it's so cohesive. And then there are some like great little one-liners. You know, like you know, dangled from a rope of sand.
Yeah.
You know, let marrow bone and cleaver choose. You know, I love when he says, from wipe him down with gasoline till his arms are hard and mean. From now on, boys, this iron boat's your home. So heave away, boys. It's like they're just like, this is just one of those songs where it's a kind of a dude's rock song. I mean,
you've gotten shanghaied, and I guess dude's rock. it's like, I mean, it's rhythmically, it's like poetic, but it's also like very like abrupt and jarring rhythmically. It's like the lines are kind of staccato and he's just throwing words out there. And like, you've got like some really like poetic lyrics. You've also got some, I don't know, weird, like you just got some weirdness in there. Like, you know, they all become Italian dreams. Always sort of like, is a line that I've always like sort of stuck with me. Like, I have no idea, but, it's fun. Although I will say, so, and this is something that's going to come up probably throughout the album. Some of it hasn't really aged as well, you know, granted 1985 is a while ago, but like, so there are lines like, you know, I've fallen for a Tawny Moore or,
The Chinaman.
Drink with all the Chinaman, which like, I'm not going to make excuses for this. It definitely seems like he's trying to evoke like the language of a certain age by using the language of a certain age.
Totally.
Yeah, like it's it doesn't age well. It doesn't, you know, almost 40 years later, things like that don't land the same way that they might have done in 1985 America, which, you know, in hindsight was not the progressive inclusive place that it might have thought it was.
Here, I thought 85 was like this utopia, right?
Yeah, we had solved racism then.
But I do think with the PC thing, it all goes back to Newman. You know, when you listen to a Randy Newman song like Rednecks, it's clearly a character.
Yeah.
You know, that is, and you know, Thomas Allen Waits is not the narrator in Singapore. You know, the narrator in Singapore uses words like, you know, uses the words that he uses in that song. And so it's kind of funny because like, and Zevon's the same way. Like, I just feel like he's like a little, these guys are kind of cancel proof. And it's like, it's not because of anything. It's not because like I'm turning a blind eye to it or anything. It's just like, they're so good at narration that like, they've created this membrane between reality and you know, fiction. And so it's so interesting. 'Cause I was thinking the same thing. Like, I can't sing along to Singapore, right? You know, like there are lines where I feel kind of funky sing along. And, but I also don't feel like it's like that offensive because of that. It's just such a weird like dichotomy.
Like a lot of it's sort of like reading it, like it's treated like reading it like a novel that takes place in like the 19th century.
Totally, kind of thing.
But
totally.
You know, that said, you know, like I think there was, especially for like male singer songwriters and like 70s, 80s, 90s, you know, even longer. Like there was like this idea like, oh, to be sort of like, I don't know, subversive or shocking, or even just like sort of demonstrate like, oh, you're tough and edgy. Like, you know, you would, you'd kind of be an asshole or like say,
Right.
So, and that's just something that we as fans have to, you know, wrestle with internally.
For sure. That's a perfectly put.
I will say last bit about Singapore. Singapore to me always sounded like if you were going to have a montage of being in an opium den, like
on the, yes,
and like a docks of some exotic port, Singapore is the song that would be playing in the background.
The bass line at the end, you guys, like, you know, the last, you know, he does the chorus one last time and then it ends, and then it kind of like there's like a sound, and then there's this bass line that I think is, and it almost sounds like there's a siren or something, and you hear like the waves, you hear the wind or something. And there's this great bass line at the end that I just, and it leads into kind of, it almost just kind of trickles over to Clap Hands. And I think, the architecture of that little riff, I think, is so cool. And it's like almost like, hey, you put up with this, not put up with it, because I do, again, I think it ends up being an amazing song in retrospect, but like, it's a perfect kind of like mood setter. Like, okay, now we're getting into some shit, you know, it's not, it ain't going to be all sea shanties here. You know, you're going to step off the ship, and you're going to fall asleep on the shore.
I mean,
and,
if you think about it, like,
kicks ass.
Singapore, the song itself is sort of, just the lyrics is about like beginning a journey or going on to like some strange, feverish, delusional place. And that's actually a pretty good start for the album, right? Like that is the journey you're going to take on this. And he's not lying to you. Like it's not the most accessible like, song.
Buckle up, man.
Yeah, it's not the most accessible song in the album. It's like, you know, hey, we're going on a crazy journey to a weird place. Here we go.
Dude, I love it. Yeah. Absolutely. And then, you know, and then to go from that to Clap Hands. By the way, your hometown gets a shout out in this song.
Oh yeah, a few towns get a shout out in this song.
That's true. Yeah, he does mention Harlem. He mentions Harlem in this song.
He mentions Cincinnati.
That's right.
It's always been some. Yeah, like I don't know. There's this thing in like, you know, this sort of like American genre of pop culture where like certain like grungy, out of the way cities, it's sort of like sort of mentioning them, like in a very much like. Almost like a noir sort of like, you know, like Marlowe kind of Philip Marlowe.
Totally, kind of dude. This is a Philip Marlowe song.
Yeah.
Like, totally.
You know, haven't seen him since Cincinnati or like Detroit, you know, Philadelphia, like Kansas City Slim finally came for me kind of, you know, right. Like, you know, just sort of mentioned like, not like the big famous, like the big glitzy coastal cities, the sort of like, you know, a little bit more rundown aging cities that like you might, that might have been bigger a while ago. And from someone like is Waits, who I think like spent most of his life in New Orleans and California too, but like, you know, mm-hmm. This is an album about New York, but he also ends up spending a lot of time talking about places outside of New York too. And sort of interesting, like what they represent sort of in that world. Right. So like, you know, a Cincinnati jacket and a sad luck dame. What's a Cincinnati?
Right, like, that is Raymond Chandler as shit. Like the whole first verse. Yeah. Like, I mean, like that, this could have been the opening line in The Big Sleep.
Yeah,
or like, you know, The Long Goodbye or something.
Sane, they're all insane. Fireman's blind, the conductor's lame. A Cincinnati jacket and a sad lunk dame. Yeah, like that is like you're a
hanging out the window with a bottle full of rain. Yeah. Like, oh my God, so good.
You're a private eye pouring yourself a glass of bourbon and then someone walks through the door with a case kind of thing. Yeah.
A sad duck dame, you know? It's
sad luck dame.
It's so good.
Yeah.
And I don't know, it's so good.
Yeah. And it's in like the pacing too, like clap hands. Like it's almost like a chant at certain parts too. Much like Singapore. Like you get to this point in the album, you're wondering like, is this actually music I'm listening to?
And we'll get to that in the next song, but like, you know, our friend Patrick, Dave and I have a mutual friend named Patrick. Patrick is also the,
brilliant editor.
He's the self-appointed executive producer of the podcast.
When Mark says self-appointed, he means we forced him to do it.
We did actually. He, famously hates Tom Waits. Well, not hates Tom Waits, but he just can't get into him. And, the next song we talk about, is one of the reasons why, but I'm trying to find the line here. I probably don't even need to do it. And I probably talked about it. There's a great book. It's called Tom Waits on Tom Waits. And it's just an edited compilation of everything he's really said about his music up to, I think this goes to Orphans, Brawlers, Ballers and Bastards, which was a compilation from 2006, which is great. Yeah. And so like all the interviews are Rolling Stone article, all the things like, you know, all the pieces. Right. And all the profiles. And he mentions about this song that he was thinking about. And it does go to the children's rhyme. Like, I forget which children's rhyme, but like, you know, where you use that rhyme scheme of like, you know, said roar, roar the thunder and the roar, son of a bitch is never coming back here no more, moon in the window and a bird on the pole. Like, you know, that type of like, la, 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 la.
Yeah, it's like
children's rhyme scheme.
I mean, it's also all slant rhymes too, right? Like, he rhymes roar, right, more, and then pole and pole.
Yeah.
Like, you rhymes dame, like, insane, dame, lane, rain.
Right.
Like, it's some pretty unusual rhyme schemes, but like you can see where he's coming from. But yeah, it's like very much like a nursery rhyme where he's talking about like, you know, going up to Harlem with a pistol in his jeans.
Right. All this like sleazy. But the one thing I love about this song, I love the percussion. There's a melody in the percussion. And that marimba serves as the primary percussion. And that's what the song starts with. But there is a weird melody to that. And it's like bum, 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 bum. Bum, 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 bum. And it sets the melody weirdly in a way that like what he did with this album with percussion, and we'll talk about it later because, you know, he famously at one point uses a 2x4. He's whacking a 2x4 against a toilet, I think, in the studio.
That is one of the most Tom Waits things I've ever heard.
Yeah. Like to achieve the sound, you know, in one of the songs. But like what they did with percussion on this album, I mean, this is an album, if you have like a good quality audio system and this is you have an evening to yourself, this is one of the just great sounding albums. And Clap Hands, set aside the fact that it is really just a well-constructed poem, just about, you know, kind of this film noir guy, like, you know, kind of going through the scuzz, you know, he's obviously running something up and down the coast, you know, to some of these cities. That it's just a well-made, good sounding song. There's a nice little arpeggio kind of guitar going on. And then like, what's his name again? Mark Ribot, whose fingerprints are all over this album. It comes in at the perfect time on every song with this like weird screaming kind of.
Yeah.
guitar. He was a guitar player just made for Tom Waits. Like that, like they were born for each other. I hope he's still alive, Mark Ribot. Let's take a look. He's alive.
Yeah, he's alive. Phew.
Shout out Mark Ribot. He's only 69. He's born in 54. Awesome dude. He's just so great.
One of the all-time great session guitarists. Yeah.
Yeah, just like he's so, I mean, it's so idiosyncratic. Like what the, like you just know right away. Like that, like, and when he comes in on this one, it's like wow, wow, like he just screams in. It's great. And I love that last line when he's like, it says like shine, shine to Roosevelt Dime, all the way to Baltimore, which is, you know, running out of time. Salvation Army seemed to wind up in the hole. They all went to heaven in a little rowboat. It's just like such a like, ugh, no notes.
Yeah, no notes. It's compelling. You know, it is, again, it's like a nursery rhyme that is, it's like a drunk telling you a nursery rhyme, like on the subway late at night.
When he, and you get like, you get another sample of like, you know, with Tom, you know, he's got different. And I wonder, like, I'd love to do actually like a long, maybe it's something I'll do on my like stupid newsletter that I never update. Like, I wonder if the way he sings, like, if there's any, like, if there's any continuity between the way he sings and like who he is. Cause like, you know, he's got a couple different styles. Like Singapore, he's got the growl, you know, like the, Clap Hands, he's got like the whisper sing.
Yeah,
you know, he's doing that whisper. No, he's not even really doing the whisper thing. He's doing like the like, like it's like the like, like snaky kind of.
Yeah, I mean, he's not even. But, arguably, he's not even singing, right? It's like
right.
You know, he's chanting. He's like, he's not exactly talking over everything, but like it's, there's a very like specific like rhythm and syncopation to it. But he's like, shine, shine, a Roosevelt dime, which doesn't sound anywhere near as good as what he does. But like, it's like,
that's pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's still gravelly, but it's not singing, right? Like, it's like a,
it's like almost rapping.
Yes.
Yeah, honestly.
Yeah. Or like a rhythmic repetition of something. Yeah.
Like, totally.
Yeah. Like, you know, when like the bards of Scots of old would like, you know, like chant some sort of like lyric poem or something like that.
Totally.
It feels more like that. Yeah. This is how the Iliad and the Odyssey were originally read, kind of thing.
Yeah. That's so well put. And that's like, I'm going to like, considering we're almost an hour into this, I'm not even taking that bait, but oh, that's so well put. You fucker.
Tune into our Greek mythology cast later on.
Oh. Yeah, I mean, Dave knows how to just cut right to the core of me, folks. You're hearing it live. I'm swooning. But yeah, I love it. Any final words on Clap Hands? I think you get final say because he mentions Baltimore.
Well, one of the great and grungy American cities, which was really made for Tom Waits in a lot of ways, which, by the way, if we're talking about Baltimore, everyone always inevitably brings up The Wire. And what?
Right.
And the theme song
famously,
for The Wire?
Tom Waits.
Right? Tom Waits, right? Like,
unbelievable.
David Simon, you know, knew what he was doing. Like, it was almost a match made in heaven.
David Simon, come on, Rain Dogs. Open invitation, David Simon.
Thank you. Also, anyone affiliated with The Wire, especially Steve Earle.
Michael K. Jordan, yeah, come on,
do it. I will say, like, we're talking about like the importance of song sequency, like opening
perfect
with
song too.
Yeah, like also perfect song. Opening with Singapore, an aggressive, bold move. Following Singapore
for sure
with like Clap Hands and not something like with Catchy or with a hook or something like that.
Yep.
An even more aggressive move, right? Like, so not only is like your opening track like a really accessible sort of like something to like really draw you in melodically, the second song is like, all right, you've made it this long. Guess what? We're getting even weirder, right, with it. And that is something that will either drive you crazy about Tom Waits or it will make you love him even harder.
Freaking amen. That's so good. Yeah, I think it's a perfect song too for that exact reason.
Yeah.
Could not agree more.
Which
leads us to, yeah, talk about balls.
Yeah. So
okay.
So we've talked about, all right, this hasn't been the most accessible song. There's been some, it's appealing to some. It can be appealing. There's like there are catchy parts of Singapore and Clap Hands. And you know, whatever else you can say about Tom Waits, he can make something kind of catchy. But it was aggressive to open with Singapore. It was bold to follow that with the clap hands. And so you're like, track number three, what's he going to have for us next? The song that he opened, he goes to next is a little something called Cemetery Polka. Which, this was well over a decade. This is like a decade before Nightmare Before Christmas came out. But like, this is a song that could easily be like a soundtrack to a Tim Burton movie.
So funny enough, my youngest, who is obsessed with Nightmare Before Christmas and hates all the music that I listen to, like he just hate it just because it's me, you know, like it's dad music, right? So like he has to just not like any of it. I lie to him and say that Cemetery Polka is from Nightmare Before Christmas. And like, so it has become part of like his song cycle. You know, like he can listen to Cemetery Polka now because he thinks it's a Tim Burton. Like, you know, he thinks it's a, what's his name? The Oingo Boingo dude who did.
Danny Elfman.
He thinks it's a Danny Elfman joint.
Yeah.
Which is hilarious.
Yeah. So Cemetery Polka is, he's sort of singing. It is right. Like, you know, he's singing more than he was. It's a polka, right? Like, you know, again, coming out in 1985 with a polka track on your album seems pretty bold.
Track three. I mean,
like
this is the third song.
Yeah.
And by the way, the first two songs are not long. So like, I mean, you're 5 minutes in, 6 minutes into this album.
That's true. Yeah. Like if you had like started like a Zeppelin album and this album at the same time, you'd still be on the first track for Zeppelin by the time you hit the third one here. Yeah. He's going quick. But it's interesting. Yeah. He's just like talking about like his weird, grotesque family, presumably walking through a cemetery. He starts with Uncle Vernon, and like, you know, Uncle William, like, you know,
right.
Uncle Violet, you know, all Uncle Bill. Like he's just like talking all of them. It's like interesting. Like, he's introducing these characters, gives you like some really weird like introductions to them, just like throws out a few facts and then just moves on to the next one. I was like, the kind of thing it reminded me.
Well, that's right on the money. That's exactly what it was.
Yeah.
Like he was being interviewed by, a guy named Michael Tiersen. It was for CBC. And Tiersen said that Cemetery Polka sounded like a kind of a peculiar family portrait. And Tom, this is the quote he gives about this song. And I always kind of was like, this was a song I skipped over. Like I used to skip over this song.
Yeah. Like
because I was like,
you hear the first few lines and you're like, all right, I got the idea. What else you got?
Right. The tumor, I would get to, it was like, and he's singing and he says, and the tumor is as big as an egg. he has a mistress. She's Puerto Rican. And I hear she has a wooden leg. And I'm like, this is not a serious song.
Yeah.
Like this is an unserious person writing an unserious song, and so I'm going to skip it because I don't want to spoil anything, but the next song is probably my favorite song on the album. I had an opinion change on this because of this quote. He says, never talk about your family in public. I learned my lesson, but I keep putting my foot in my mouth. I'm going to get calls from my Auntie Mame now. I'm going to get calls from Uncle Biltmore, Uncle William, Uncle Vernon, all of them, you know, your Uncle Phil, you know. It always happens. Uncle Phil can't live without his pills. He has emphysema and he's almost blind. I was walking through the cemetery and these were the things that I heard in the dining room during my family reunions. And I just never forgot them. So like he literally, this is a family portrait. Like like you said, he's walking through the cemetery. It's kind of Lincoln in the Bardo-esque,
yeah.
Right?
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
Like,
it's like it's a Saunders story, right? Yeah. But also, like you said, like
all these spirits are still with him. It's kind of beautiful, like in a way. It's like you carry on these little vignettes of like the people who are kind of in and out. Like I have uncles and aunts that are long gone. Some I was really, really close to, and some that I only have those little things, you know, those tiny little memories that are just a guy who couldn't live without his pills or had a one-legged mistress or something, you know, like everybody's got one.
Yeah. And also like from like the interview, it's like, these aren't just these aren't even like memories of him hanging out with them, right? These are memories of him as a child listening to his family members gossip about other family members, right? Like, these aren't like, this is all he knows. So he's only telling us that, like, you know, someone is, you know, like, Uncle William made a million during World War II, and they're tightwads.
I love that line.
And they'll never give a dime to you. Great line. But also, like, that's something that he, you know, that's something he heard, like, his aunts and uncles are, like, whispering about, like, at a family reunion.
And that is such a, like, Yinzer thing. You know, I know so many, like, I'll be at a funeral, you know, and, like, you know, you'll go to a funeral, and, like, you'll be at the, like, dinner or, like, the lunch after, and they'll be like, you know, he made a lot of money back in, you know.
Yeah.
And they never gave it to anybody because they were cheap. You know, like, it's cheap, just such a classic.
Oh, yeah. Like, family just sort of, like, whispering behind. And like, and, you know, when you're a kid, that's all you, that sticks with you. That's all you hear. And now that's all you associate with them. It's, I will say, like, something that's, like, this kind of song strongly reminds me of is, I was watching Todd in the Shadows on YouTube. I don't know if you know it. It's a pretty, like, you know.
I heard of it, but I have not watched it.
It's a really good YouTube channel, like a guy who breaks down music and songs. He's got a really great show called One Hit Wonderland, like series called One Hit Wonderland.
Okay. Yep.
So I was, it probably won't surprise anyone to know that I'm a pretty big Butthole Surfers fan. And he, like, was doing Pepper by Butthole Surfers, which is
great.
One of the great songs of the 90s. And he's, and listening to it again, I realized, like, you know, it's basically just, like, listing, like, a bunch of people and a few weird things about them, like, plays piano like a kid out in the rain, but, like, you know, he lost his legs, he was dancing with a train, something like that.
Holy shit. Yeah,
or, like, if you know Jim...
That's, like, totally Waits coded. Right. I think they were totally in this.
Yeah, like, with Electric Ladyland came out, like, like 96, so, like, it was a decade later. But also, like, Jim Carroll Band, People Who Died, was just, like, listing of, you know, like, OD'd on Train or whatever. It's just, like, you get, it's, like, a list of people and then just, like, a bunch of terrible things or things that happened to them. You're just, like, you're running through acquaintances and sort of describing them. On the more poignant side of that, you have Lyle Lovett. Was that song? Was it Family Preserve or something like that?
Similar.
Right.
But, like, very similar.
Lyle Lovett sings it, and it's, like, heart-wrenching too, right? Like, you just want to sob the whole way through. Jim Carroll Band does it, and it's, like, it's sad, but you want to headbang. Butthole Surfers do it, and it's fun, right? It's, like, their one-hit song, and you just want to, like watch a video of them, like, trashing Nine Inch Nails trailer at Lollapalooza or something like that, because that's just the fun stuff they did. But you listen to, like, but, like, Tom Waits does it, and you're like, this is really weird. Like, you know, but you also get a sense of these people, right? Like, it's like, this is like an Edward Gorey story, right? Like, just, like, the grotesque
Edward
character.
Dude.
Yeah.
He gets compared a lot to Edward Gorey, and he gets compared a lot to Edward Hopper, too.
American Gothic.
The painter.
Yeah.
But I, you know, it's funny, you mentioned those types of songwriters, and, like, I was been super hyper-fixated on this one Proto-Martyr song, because I think Proto-Martyr is so good, and they have a song called Half Sister that, and Joe Casey does a very similar thing, where, like, what you mentioned, like, the Butthole Surfers, like, the method of that songwriting, but Joe Casey goes through, like, old headlines. He goes to, like, the library in Detroit. They all, the band's from Detroit. And he just looks up weird stories. And then he will almost crib the stories verbatim for the songs. Like, he just kind of takes license and just takes whatever he can. And so there is a verse in Half Sister. I just pulled it up, and I just love it so much. It's, he says, in northern Michigan, there was an incident in winter. A horse was hit by lightning and began to speak in a foreign language. When he was finally understood, it repeated, humans are no good. So they shot it behind the shed and stuffed him. Now he's on display as a lesson for the kids to always do your best always. And I just, like, cause like, and you know, of course, you know, I found an interview where they were talking about him, and Joe Casey said, yeah, there was this story of this horse that got struck by lightning, and it was, like, speaking Farsi or something. And, like, and, you know, To be able to take that and, like, drop it into a song is, like, such a gift. And I feel like Tom Waits does that time and time again, where, like, he'll hear someone say something on a train and, like, he'll turn it into the most profound, like, statement on humanity ever. And, like, that is very Bukowski-esque and very, Burroughs-esque in some, you know, in a lot of ways. It's very, you know, the beats, you know, they just are so fixated on these aspects of life that are like, they're obsessed with the rawness and realness, and like a lot of it kind of aged kind of cornily, you know, and it's aged a little bit kind of edgelordy. But I think, and maybe like where I am in my life where I'm like revisiting these things I loved as a youth when I was an idiot, you know, moron. There is like a kind of a interesting like realness to it. And for a song like this, it just sounds so like dumb. You know what I mean? Like cosmetically, this song is, you're like, what the fuck? This is track three on this masterpiece album. It's a polka that, it sounds like a Tim Burton song, like, but you know, for it to be this kind of cute, almost kind of moving, it's almost moving, you know, in retrospect to think of it. And so that's another Waits bomb, just dropping it in song number three. Killer, man. Just so good.
Again, and just the utter confidence of him as an artist to have this like really weird polka about all his like grotesque caricatures of his like, you know, descriptions of his family. It's track number three, after he's already had a couple of kind of not particularly easy to listen to tracks, which is, again, once you like the fun thing about Rain Dogs is it's probably one of, like, if you're trying to get someone into Tom Waits, Rain Dogs is the album you recommend, right? Like, you know, maybe Swordfish Trombones or something, but like Rain Dog is usually the top of the list. But the first few songs on the list, you're not going to like until you already like the album.
Which is like, again, it's such a like baptism by fire. And again, like you said, I mean, this is a guy so locked in, like with the intention. And I believe by now he was writing, is this an album that he was doing with his wife? I think, like, you know, she is just like, we can't even really go. I feel like I can't even go further without mentioning Kathleen Brennan.
Oh, but, yeah,
like,
for sure.
Who is just so like one of the great. Yeah. Okay. So they were married in 1980. She is an amazing photographer and artist in her own right. And, you know, clearly the minute that she and Waits kind of connected, his art just got so much better. You know, and I love the early Tom Waits. I mean, hopefully, God willing, we'll get to them maybe in 2020, maybe 2045 or something. But I mean, her fingerprints are all over this. And like, you know, to be able to do this on song three, is clearly you got to have somebody, another person in the room as confident in your kind of shit as you are. And she's, you know, such a badass. I'm such a crush on her, like from artistic, like I have an artistic crush on her, man.
Another sort of, yeah, like a really fruitful and important artistic collaboration that, you know, the woman does not get nearly enough credit for. also something we like, so again, this is an album about New York City. We are three tracks in, no mention of any, like almost no mention of anything New York related. There was a Harlem reference in the last song. This is all of his family members. Some of them might have been based in New York, but you have no idea. This is his like his personal recollections and memories kind of thing.
So it's like mentioning New York. So now we're out of the cemetery, and we are dropped into another vignette. Now we've got like a there's like a whip percussion going on there. There's like some kind of like horse or like a bullwhip, and there's this kind of Latin based it's a song about a ostensibly it's about a horse, a man who races horses being drunk, but you know, among other things. Most days this is my favorite song. Jockey Full of Bourbon.
Yeah,
sorry that we didn't mention it till now.
Jockey Full of Bourbon, like, which is
broken cup.
you know, depending on how you want to approach it, this is the first track on the album that actually feels like a song, right? Like, if you were a studio exec in 1985, you're like, oh, maybe this is the, like, you know, I get it. We're cool. We're edgy. We're going to be kind of like dark and gritty. Maybe this is how you open your album. And no, it's track number 4. But yeah, it's got a good rhythm. It's he's kind of singing in this one. And by the way,
he's doing like the whisper song.
Yeah. Like,
yeah.
Jack, like, you know, like it's almost, you know how like Billie Eilish made like the whisper singing cool, again, uh-huh, with like, is it Bad Guy? But like, but this is all of that, you know, like, but yeah, like, and you know, I don't know if Billie Eilish is her brother's, her brother and collaborator, was it Phineas something? I should know that. Yeah. They both just won an Oscar. But yeah, like, you know, it's like a very similar kind of thing, like the cool rhythmic whisper singing. And it's compelling, right? And it's compelling in a way that the other songs were compelling too, but it's a song that more than anything else on the album so far, like, grabs you. The others are like, you know, you kind of had to already be there to sort of to appreciate it. And this one, it's like, if you're like a skeptical, if you're coming in as a skeptic or haven't gotten into them already, like, I think for a lot of people, this is the track of the album where you're like, okay, I see where you're coming from. I think I can get on board with this.
Well, it's like the guy takes a narrative, like, you know, the story song format, you know, this is not, you know, The Last of Barrett's Privateers, you know, where like, it's like, oh, the year was 1778.
Yeah.
You know, and it's this, like, you're dropped. And I love, you know, like, one of my favorite, I was just talking about this with somebody about some movies nowadays and books nowadays, where like, what's so cool about the movie The Dark Knight is like, you are immediately dropped into the middle of a heist, right?
Yeah.
You know, they're robbing a bank. And you're immediately like, and they're talking about the Joker, you know, but you don't see the Joker till the very, you know, and there's these contextless things, like the guy, the main actor who's the bank manager is a quasi famous actor. I forget his name. He's like a character actor.
Oh, is it William Fichtner? Like, I want to say.
Yeah, dude.
He, from Heat, right? Like he was in like,
yes,
he's been in some of the best heist movies of all time.
Right. And like, so there's like, okay, so I feel like I should know him. He might be important because he's, you know, a guy that's in a lot of things like this. And you know, this, the first like verse here, it's like a bullet train through like something, you know, and I just think it's like, you know, the mentions of Edna Milton in a drop dead suit, Dutch pink on a downtown train, $2 pistol, but the gun won't shoot. I'm in the corner on the pouring rain. 16 men on a dead man's chest, and I've been drinking from a broken cup, 2 pairs of pants and a mohair vest. I'm full of bourbon. I can't stand up. Like, I just, like, that is,
it's
an immediate mood. It's a mood set,
right?
You know?
And also, like we talked about, like, oh, this is like a Philip Marlowe, like, noir detective, yeah, novel. And also we've talked about, like, oh, this is kind of like Singapore. Like, oh, this is kind of like a pirate song. And this is feels like both, uh-huh, of those themes converging right now, right? Like, we're talking,
totally,
about, like, standing,
yeah,
on the corner, like, a 2-dollar pistol won't shoot, standing on the corner in the pouring rain. And then we're talking about, like, 16 men on a dead man's chest, right? Like, we're just sort of, like, getting a convergence of those sort of, like, of the sort of like genre influences. Also, you know, at this point, it's on the nose. We have to say it. You were talking about The Dark Knight.
Yes.
What one of Heath Ledger's like influences,
oh, yeah,
as the Joker, like when he's like trying to get into character and figure out who he is, what does he look to? Tom Waits interviews and like listen to Tom Waits.
Smacked out Tom Waits, yeah, in the 70s. Yeah, yeah, totally. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. I didn't even think about that. But one quick thing, I was just curious as I was reading those lyrics if Edna Milton was a person.
So
I looked them up, and of course it's a famous Texas brothel madam. She was a famous madam in a Texas brothel,
like best little whorehouse in Texas kind of thing, or
must be. I don't know if she was based on it, but she was she was a person. There's photographs of her. Yes. Oh my God! It is the best little whorehouse.
Yeah, yeah. There we go. Damn.
Yeah, it was the inspiration for that.
So I will say, on Spotify, if you look at the lyrics, it's not Edna Milton. I just checked this. It's Edna Million.
Oh.
Like like the number million.
Edna Million.
So don't trust Spotify for your lyrics, kids. Oh, quick Edna Milton fact. When do you would you think she died? R.I.P.
Had it in like 1960, whorehouse. I want to say like the 90s.
2012.
Wow. Yeah. Okay.
Texas Monthly.
Edna had a good run, yeah. Dude.
Which is a great
magazine. How old was she?
She was 84.
Oh, man. I just looked at... Oh, wow. So that rocks.
Yeah.
Absolutely rocks. The other thing about this song that I love is like... I don't know. This song reminds me so much of like my youth in a weird way. And it reminds me of like being... Like this is a song... Even if you like... Take the lyrics out, you know, in the second song, I believe, you know, there's a Cuban jail reference, you know, the protagonist is, I love the line, I've been stepping on the devil's tail. Oh, I think that's just such a cool line, but, I love, I'm on the lawn with someone else's wife.
I'm on the lawn with someone else's wife.
You know, I love the acknowledgement of like, I don't know. It just reminds me of being like in over your head.
Yeah.
And like anyone who's ever like young, like even the verse, like, or the chorus, like, hey, little bird, fly away home. Your house is on fire. Your children are alone.
Oh yeah.
You know, like it's like, you're somewhere you're not supposed to be. You think you're supposed to be here. You have imposter syndrome. Go home, you know, go home to your quiet little home. Like your kids want you home. You shouldn't be here.
Yeah.
You know, you shouldn't be doing this.
Yeah.
And I just like, everyone has felt that way. You know, like everyone has walked into a room full of these characters and been like, I got to get home. This isn't for me. I'm not supposed to be here.
Yeah. I mean, and a consistent theme throughout this album, and this song especially, is, you know, he's talking about sort of like the dregs and fringes of society. Like, you know, Jackie Phillip Urban, like, it's, you know, Jackie Phillip Urban, I can't step up. It's someone who's like drunk at a bar. Right.
Yeah.
And he's like sort of like talking about this stuff, but he's not glorifying it or glamorizing it in any way.
No.
You're certainly not trying to. Like, yeah, hey, little bird, fly away home. Your house on fire, your children. Like, this, I mean, it's a warning to someone, right? Like saying, like, hey, you're not supposed to be here. You got things to take care of. You've got things you need to deal with. And, you know, and the thing that always struck me with the song is like, maybe this is just someone he's talking to at a bar, like, you know, someone he's flirting with, someone who's like with him, like someone who's in over a little bit over their head, like you said, or maybe it's him, right? Like maybe he's talking about like,
right,
what am I doing here? Like, I have a life. I got a family that, like, you know, I am not dealing with all this stuff. I am just here getting drunk kind of thing. And yeah, say, Tom Waits does a great job of not glamorizing a lot of, like, you know, like portraying a lot of things in a really like compelling way without necessarily, like, you know, making them seem like cool or appealing, right? Like, you know, you don't listen to Tom Waits and think, oh man, I really want to try heroin.
I really want oh man, I really want to get so drunk that I can't stand up on bourbon, you know, because nothing bad happens.
Yeah.
You know, you know what I just looked up for context is how old, and I never had done this before, how old he was when he made this album.
Oh.
He was 37.
Okay. So about our age. Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
Plenty of, like, time to fuck up your life. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Like, this is primo. Like, I was like, our age is the primo, like, I'm rebooting.
Yeah.
You know, like, I know some guys I'm not going to call out on here that are essentially in that kind of phase where they're like, okay, like, we're just going to get a fresh start. And I think Tom Waits is like, that music is so for those people, but even like, not necessarily like a hard reset where like your house is literally on fire.
Yeah.
You know, but I think he is creatively someone who's just always trying to push it. And it's just like, kind of like, you know, it's so cool that he was a middle-aged dude. You know, he was a middle-aged married guy when he made this album. He had kids probably. I think they had, because they were married in 1980.
Yeah.
So it's cool to think, like, you know, this is not a time when, like, people are putting out their most creative, like, you know, people are not known to put out their best work at 37.
How dare you?
In rock and roll.
You're at your
peak. In rock and roll. Well, no. Other mediums for sure, but like rock and roll is not a not a place for a middle aged guy.
Yeah, it's generally considered like a younger person's game.
It's a young man's game. Yeah.
Well, like stereotypically, right? But you know, like.
But all my favorite artists have made music their whole lives, and I, you know, it might be the contrarian in me, or maybe it's the fact that I myself am aging every day. But I love the stuff that they're all like. I love. Even Paul Simon, like Paul Simon's last album, or maybe the second to last album he did, is like kicks so much ass, like, and you know, all of them, you know, like everybody knows how I feel about the last Bob Dylan album. I'm not even going to go there. And you know, whatever Waits does, if he decides to do another one, I'm going to be the biggest freakazoid on the planet about it. We're going to have to do an emergency episode.
Oh,
the minute that drops.
Sure. Also, like I will say, so Paul Simon's a great example of this. Paul Simon makes Graceland, which I think is one of the best albums of all time. Just like
no top debate to tail.
He was 45, right? So like,
yep.
Let's say, right, you know, if you're in your late 30s, 40s, whatever, you can still make good music. So by all
means. I love it.
But also, like the thing with like with Rain Dogs, this is not an album that someone in their 20s could have made, right? Compellingly, right? Like,
could not agree more.
If like a 26-year-old tried to make this, you wouldn't buy it at all, right? This is this is someone with some like
it would feel like so
This would be
especially this song,
yeah.
Oh, for this sure. particular song in general,
yeah. It would feel like, I mean, unless you were just like an exceptionally good storyteller who has had like a rough go of things already, like it would feel like someone who like read some Bukowski like his head, and then like, you know, tried to like make stuff up from here. Like this whole album feels lived in. It feels written by someone with some mileage under the hood, and it has to feel that way, or otherwise it's not gonna work.
I do feel like this is the reward, I think, for making it this far, you know, like it's 1985. You just pulled your stonewashed jeans out of the dryer and you put them on and you opened a beautiful, crisp, cool can of Pepsi. Mm-hmm. You're about to like, you know, get in your Acura NSX and like, you know, do cocaine somewhere. Mm-hmm. And you read the Rolling Stone review for this and it's the greatest, you know, album of the world or whatever. You buy it, you throw it on the record player, and you're like, "What? I'm a Huey Lewis fan. What did I just do?"
Right.
This is the reward for getting through the first three songs.
Yeah.
It's like, and by the way, three songs that I adore, and like, gun to my head, they're in my top probably 25 Tom Waits songs. Maybe not. I don't know. We'll rank them all at the end of this. But this is a song. It has the structure of a song. There's a verse and a chorus.
Yeah. It has a hook.
There is,
like, you know, like
it has a hook. Yeah, it has an actual hook.
You could imagine this being on the radio.
It's one of those songs where you're like, if you give any rip about what a song can do narrative wise, you listen to the song and you're just like, this is almost not fair what he did in this song. And almost to the, I love the way at the end how he kind of like almost like breaks down saying it. He just keeps going, you know. It's so good. Ugh.
It feels like just like a, you know, like a drunk sort of like at a table like muttering something to himself over and over again until he passes out. Yeah, which is, I think, the vibe he's going for. But yeah, it's just, it's a great song. Like
this is a poet. This is a poet who is ready to just rock your face off. Like he's going to just make you feel feelings. Tom Waits is here to make you feel feelings.
Yeah. Not good feelings necessarily, but feelings.
No. And you know, for me, and you know, this kind of ends like a chapter, I guess, right? Of the album. Yeah. Is that what you would say?
Yeah. So like, I think the first like three songs leading into this are almost like a test of your willpower in some ways. Again, if you're coming in kind of fresh, but if, you know, if you're already on board, if you've listened to this a few times, you're a convert, then it's sort of like, I don't know, like an orientation almost. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, right. So Singapore is, we're launching the voyage. Clap Hands is sort of like, you know, we're setting the sort of tone, right? Like it's sort of like this weird sort of like almost chanting rhythmic getting to it. Cemetery Polka is like, all right, we're just going to like wander around and have some introductions to some weird people, and then jockey full of bourbon is, all right, we've sort of like, we've touched all of those like bases. We can have some music now, or we can have some melody now, I guess is probably more accurate. We're going to mix all of that up together, and we're going to launch into the rest of the album.
Yeah, this is the moment where it really launches, you know, for me. This is the launch point. And, you know, the more and more I think about it, the more I think those first three songs not only are a test of will, but they are kind of like a statement of purpose too, because it's like,
yeah,
this is not Huey Lewis. And no disrespect to Huey Lewis, who rocks. I mean, everything Huey Lewis ever has done kicks ass. So I'm not here to disparage anything, but like, this is not this is not an album that you buy and put on the first CD player that was put into a car, you know, and like, think you're going to like put your top down and like, you know, drive up Mulholland Drive listening to. I mean, you can, but you know, this is a novel, or this is Edward Hopper, you know, this is something that you're going to experience. So, yeah, I mean, so that I think concludes at least this chapter of where we want to talk about the album. What is your, you got any, like, what's the take home, Dave, you know, before we wrap this baby up and put it out there for the masses?
Yeah, it's like, I think the tendency when people are talking about Rain Dogs is like, sort of talk about like, to see it as sort of a work of, It's very grim and dark and grotesque in a lot of ways. And I think that's really easy to focus on. And so, like, a lot of people are, like, you know, talking about, like, how this is Tom Waits's, like, ode to, like, the dispossessed, the fringes of society. And that's absolutely the theme here. But I think, like, just looking at it all again and thinking about it, what I'm really most struck by is, like, just how confident all of this is. Like, this is an artist who is, like, he knows what he's doing. He knows what he wants to do. He's not worried at all about losing his audience. He's very much like, this is who I am. This is what I've got. We're just going to start. We're going to go Singapore. Then we're going to clap hands. Then we're going cemetery polka. And maybe you can get a little something fun with Jockey Full of Bourbon.
Right.
But like, he's, you know, this isn't like a, I don't know what, I'm not going to speak to like what his internal state is at the time when he does this, but like, This is an album designed by someone who is just either totally confident or totally indifferent to like what his audience thinks, because this is what he wants to say. And he's not going to worry about losing people after the first song or two, because if you are, you don't sequence the album this way. Statement of purpose. Like, this is a very strong thesis statement.
Right. I think we mentioned it on the Clovis episode. That is so funny to talk about, because that was like so long ago. You know, he was doing a lot of weird shit when he was making this album. Like, he was living with these like interesting people, and he would listen to the pipes. You know, he would like go to the basement of his building and listen to the steam and the, you know, the machinery of New York City, kind of like, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Being, and like, it's just
clanking and like,
yeah.
Yeah.
And it's just like, that is so in the spirit of this album, and it really is the heartbeat. The New York, you know, he's not mentioning it as like, okay, like he's in Singapore in the first song, all these things, but like,
or going to Singapore, anyway, right?
Right. Like, yeah. Oh yeah, that's right. But like, New York is really the heartbeat, you know. And anyone who's ever been like, you know, Manhattan, you know, very late at night, early in the morning, and like, so evocative of that, and it's a vibe, and I'm super stoked that we're finally doing this, and that we'll go through this album and hopefully many more. So
long overdue.
We're procrastinators, forgive us, listeners. that first episode was so good, we just had to leave them hanging for 2 years. That's just how it goes.
You gotta let it sit sometimes. All right. Well,
cool. Well, thank you for listening, everybody. Thank you, Dave.
Thank you, Mar. Until next time, we're the Rain Dogs.
For I am a Rain Dog, too.
Thank you for listening. This has been a WTF production. See you next time.